is a cool recording, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop. Right on. What's
up? Hey, man, what's your name?
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, oh, what's going on.
Marvin Gaye's What's Going On was released 50 years ago in 1971. It was the height of the Vietnam War. Obie Benson from the Motown group The Four Tops got the idea for the song having seen police attacking anti-war protesters. He said, "The police was beating on them, but they weren't bothering anybody. I saw this and started wondering what the fuck was going on. What is happening here?" One question led to another. Why are they sending kids far away from their families overseas? Why are they attacking their own kids in the street? The Four Tops decided they didn't want the song and passed it to Marvin, who'd been deeply affected by receiving letters from his brother Frankie in Vietnam. He could hear the pain, the anger, the brutalization of these young, disproportionately black soldiers who knew they shouldn't be there. And so a great album, still relevant 50 years on, was born. There were dozens and dozens of great records released during after the war, some directly attacking it and questioning why the US was intervening, some not directly about Vietnam, but captured a mood, and some in response to hearing about the soldiers who had started to understand that their actual enemy was their own government. Now, the US should not have been so resolutely defeated in Vietnam. They had a fantastically advanced military compared with the underdeveloped Vietnamese. I mean, Vietnam's entire GDP was a fraction of the US military budget. But lose they did, with massive consequences for US foreign policy until the collapse of the USSR in 1991. And there are three reasons why. Firstly, the magnificent resistance of the peasant army of Vietnamese people themselves. Secondly, the anti-war movement in the US and other imperialist nations such as Australia and the UK. And thirdly, the rebellion of GIs, both in army bases in the US and on the ground in Vietnam. Obviously, this last one is the focus of this talk, and I think it's been important to do so because it's often forgotten about at best or deliberately overlooked at worst in most mainstream histories of the war. But let's take a little step back and look at why the US intervened in Vietnam in the first place. For decades, the US had attempted to prevent nationalist forces taking power in Vietnam. In 1954, after a nine-year war, French imperialism was defeated, and the US engineered a division of the country into two, the communist North and the anti-communist puppet regime in the South. For 10 years, as the Cold War raged, the US tried to stabilize a Saigon government, which was hugely unpopular with the majority of people. Having divided the country, the US sent troops to Vietnam to stop the National Liberation Front, the NLF, from coming to power with their aim of reunification. The US ruling class also wanted to stop the domino effect of seeing another country fall to communism. They believed that if Vietnam went, others in the region would follow, and use this belief to justify such strong intervention. As early as 1965, when ground troops were sent into Vietnam, they knew they couldn't win. This was publicly acknowledged in 1970 when Vice President Spiro Agnew went on TV and said, "We know we can't win a ground war in Asia." This despite this being their strategy for the previous 5 years. According to the Pentagon Papers, a series of documents leaked by Daniel Ellsberg to the New York Times in 1971, The Assistant Secretary of Defense wrote this about the aims of the US in their action in South Vietnam as early as 1965. So they wrote the aims were, quote, 70% to avoid a humiliating US defeat after years of intervention, 20% to keep South Vietnam out of the hands of the Chinese, i.e. those pesky communists, and 10% to permit the people of South Vietnam to enjoy a better, freer way of life. I mean, 10%, how generous. Yet despite this last one being the least important reason to them, this was what was told to the American public and the troops as justification for their involvement. As with Afghanistan and Iraq in the early 2000s, they used democracy and liberation as their excuse for intervention, when it was actually about ensuring the US's military and political dominance in the region. To paraphrase one of our comrades from a recent episode of Red Flag Radio, when talking about Afghanistan, you won't find liberation at the end of an AK-47 or a cluster bomb. The Pentagon Papers also revealed that four US presidents had systematically lied to the American public and to Congress for years. Ellsberg was then a national security analyst with top security clearance and was arrested and tried under the Espionage Act. He said that he leaked the papers to stop the war as soon as possible, outraged that, quote, they knew we wouldn't win and they still sent boys to die. Now, we might be used to the idea of our ruling class lying through their teeth every time they open their mouths, but it's not often revealed for the world to see in such a clear way, especially after decades of Cold War propaganda that had resonated with large sections of the population. And so for lots of people, this was an absolute betrayal of trust from the highest office in the land. By 1968, the facade of fighting to free Vietnam from the stranglehold of communism was completely destroyed, because at the start of 68, the NLF engaged in the Tet Offensive, attacking towns and cities all over the country, all over the South, with some fighters even making it as far as the US Embassy in Saigon. While they were ultimately defeated, losing thousands of fighters along the way, the Tet Offensive showed that the NLF had the support of people in the South. Someone had to look the other way, someone had to open the doors and so on for them to get as far as they did. The illusion that the Viet Cong were on the ropes and the US had everything in hand was completely shattered. They were fighting the whole of the Vietnamese people, not just a minority of communists in the North. Despite it being described by Lyndon B. Johnson as a raggedy-ass little fourth-rate country, Vietnam proved to the world, especially the developing world, which was in the process of ridding itself of the shackles of colonialism, that US imperialism could be resisted. The resistance of people fighting the invading force and the resistance of people fighting their own government's imperialist drive to military domination were the major factors in this victory. So I think you have to understand the emergence and widespread nature of the soldiers' rebellion in the context of these revelations, that they couldn't win, and the revelations of the lies that we're told to justify the war, as well as some other factors, an important one being the class nature of the armed forces. The US working class made up the vast majority of people who were sent to Vietnam, and their average age was just 19. The form of conscription known as the draft excluded eligible men on college, professional, or medical grounds, or if they were enrolled in the National Guard. The majority of enlisted men, or the grunts as they were not so affectionately known, had a high school education or less. The upper classes simply didn't fight. While working class high schools often saw 20 or 30% of their students shipped off to Vietnam, the 1970 graduating class from Harvard saw two out of their 1,200 students sent there. Virtually all of the middle class men who were of the age to be sent to Vietnam were in college, so got a deferment, but if they couldn't defer or if they aged out, they would often end up in the National Guard. If they were sent to Vietnam, they were often not assigned to combat roles, but to support units instead. The likes of George W. Bush used daddy's influence to get him into the safe confines of the Texas Air National Guard, and Donald Trump dodged the draft five times, four times while in college, and the fifth due to a favourable medical diagnosis reportedly provided by a doctor who rented office space from Trump Sr. High school dropouts were three times more likely to be sent to the combat units that did the fighting and got injured and got killed. And here there was a racial element too. It was virtually impossible to get into the National Guard if you were Black. And while Black men made up about 12% of the troops in Vietnam, they made up about 25% of the combat units. And so if this is the composition of the troops on the ground, the vast majority of combat troops coming from the working class and the middle class filling the ranks of the officers, that class dynamic will play out in the field. While the war could not have been fought without them, the combat troops were seen as expendable because you could always conscript more. The middle class support officers were far removed from the danger and were often completely unnecessary, much like any supervisor or manager in any other workplace. To add fuel to the fire, enlisted men had to complete a one-year tour of duty in Vietnam, while tours for officers were only 6 months. This resulted in officers having little experience of battle, putting soldiers' lives at risk and breeding contempt and resentment for those using those short tours to prove themselves for promotion. They had a short period of time to prove that their commands were a success. So the body count from search and destroy missions became the key piece of evidence in that proof. Going out to kill anything that moves might be a surefire way to get a high figure, but they also produced high casualties for the soldiers, who were obviously more reluctant to go out there and risk their lives just to earn their boss a promotion that took him even further away from the battlefield. And it's here that some of the first elements of resistance start to take place. So just to say a quick little something about those search and destroy missions and the body count. So there were no fixed battlegrounds to target, as the NLF was made up of peasant troops and supporters who would work their land during the day and attack US troops and bases at night, setting mines, then disappearing back into the countryside. The search and destroy missions were designed to root out these supporters, and their success was determined by the body count, how many NLF troops were killed. So the Vietnamese people as a whole became the enemy. If the success of the war was judged by the body count, then kill them even if they try to surrender, as one soldier recalled his commanding officer saying, open the door to random slaughter and brutality. So what did the GI rebellion actually look like? In the early days of the war, people were making individual decisions about what they were prepared to do. They were sometimes from military families who believed in the war, or at least believed in doing their job and following the chain of command. But their conscience told them something else when they were faced with the reality. The documentary Sir No Sir opens with the story of a dermatologist who was training soldiers in rudimentary skills so that they would be able to cure the basic skin conditions of people in the villages, winning the hearts and minds, if you like. But his side was also bombing villages in the north, and he couldn't quite stand the double standard. For refusing to train those soldiers, he was court-martialed and served just over 2 years in prison. A soldier who went on an anti-war demonstration and held up a sign saying, end Johnson's fascist aggression in Vietnam, got a 2-year sentence. Two black soldiers received 6 to 10 year sentences for organising a meeting simply asking whether black people should support the war. But the more they cracked down, the more support those soldiers who questioned the war received, and the more seeds of doubt were sown in the minds of the soldiers around them. The Tet Offensive proved to be a decisive moment, not just in terms of the war itself, but also the resistance to it. Increasingly, both the American public and the soldiers came to realise that they weren't a liberating force at all, fighting off the communist hordes, but rather an invading force with absolutely no right to be there. It was the moment when the isolated incidents of individual discontent became organised. Remember, for a soldier during wartime to say he wasn't going to fight was mutiny. It's the worst thing you could do as a soldier and was punishable by death. It was not something undertaken lightly. But the power to punish every act of resistance on the scale that was needed had completely collapsed. Prior to 1968, it was much easier for soldiers' individual acts to be punished, and punishments were severe, as I talked about earlier. Resistance developed from people deciding that they would individually refuse an order to whole combat units doing so. Search and destroy became search and avoid, as soldiers would go out as ordered, but make up reports of engagement with the enemy. That soon turned into outright mutiny, as they simply refused to go out on these missions. And these were sustained events, not just one-offs, and the officers had no way of disciplining them. In an article in the International Socialist Review, Joel Geyer talks about the time a whole company, Company A of the 3rd Battalion, which had already lost nearly a third of its men, refused to advance after taking heavy fire for 5 days. A GI newspaper, The Bond, noted, quote, it was an organised strike. A shaken brass relieved the company commander, but they didn't charge the guys with anything. The brass surrendered to the strength of the organised men. So, Here we have ordinary working class people exercising their collective strength, and there was nothing those above them could do about it. In fact, they were the ones who had to be transferred out, given a different command, rather than being left to face an insubordinate unit. Word of mutiny and resistance was spreading, boosted by an increasingly vocal anti-war movement at home. And how did that resistance become so organised? Some of it was to do with those one-year tours, which meant there was a constant revolving door of soldiers returning home, talking to those about to go over in the dozens of coffee houses that had sprung up near the army bases.
Fort Hood was both a combination of guys going to Vietnam and guys who'd been to Vietnam and came back. And as time went on, the guys who had been to Vietnam played a subversive role to the guys who were going.
And they go out on ambushes. Like for a 1 month period, we go out on ambushes and we kill over 50 people in the early hours of the morning. And
can you not hear it?
Bodies because they've got to get their body count. Who's there?
Oh, wow.
Well, the majority were women and children. And what were they doing? What was their crime? They were carrying food. They were carrying food to their friends up in the hills.
More than 300 anti-war newspapers were published throughout the world by and for US active duty soldiers on military bases and ships from 1968 to 1972. These newspapers expressed the voices of hundreds and thousands of soldiers who spoke out against the war and against injustices and racism within the military itself. They spread the message of resistance across the country and into Vietnam, providing an outlet for their rage and letting them know they weren't alone. The GI Coffee House Network was relatively short-lived, but it was an important part of the anti-war movement. There were these pervasive myths that the anti-war movement was at odds with US troops, but the newspapers and coffee houses paint a very different picture. They took out full-page ads in major newspapers with the names of thousands of soldiers who were against the war. They formed their own organisations, most famously Vietnam Veterans Against the War, held their own marches, and sometimes, especially after 1968, not only joined the bigger anti-war marches, but led them, often in full uniform. Now, by the time you get soldiers ready to kill their own officers, it's a bit of a sign that your army's starting to fall apart. Official records show that such incidents skyrocketed in the last 3 years of the war, but there was so much that didn't even get recorded. The term fragging was based on the fragmentation grenades that would be thrown into officers' tents, but became the general term used when soldiers killed their superior officers. It was a sign of how desperate the soldiers were not to be sent on missions that would mean they would almost certainly be killed, see their fellow soldiers killed, or be made to brutally kill the supposed enemy. But it was also an explicit political tactic designed to stop the war. One GI newspaper demanded, "Don't desert, go to Vietnam and kill your commanding officer." The precise numbers are unclear, but because they didn't want to record exactly how widespread this was, but records do show that there were 126 fraggings in 1969, 271 in 1970, 333 in 1971, and then they stopped counting. They were not random or deliberately cruel, but strategic and deliberately targeted. The officers were often given several warnings, again, showing that the motive was not necessarily to actually kill them, but to stop them sending them out on dangerous missions. If they couldn't get them in their tents, officers were sometimes accidentally shot while on mission. It proved to be a deeply effective way of eventually stopping the war. You can't win a war with such open hostility to orders and a ground force who was willing to kill their bosses. And the idea that they were ready to turn their guns on their rulers on the battlefield put the fear of God into the US ruling class, thinking about what that anger might get turned into once they returned home. This sentiment was captured by these words written in the Armed Forces Journal in 1971. Quote, "Our army that now remains in Vietnam is in a state approaching collapse, with individual units avoiding or having refused combat, murdering their officers and non-commissioned officers, drug-ridden and dispirited when not near mutinous. Conditions exist among American forces in Vietnam that have only been exceeded in this century by the collapse of the Tsarist armies in 1916 and 1917. I mean, you can hear the sheer panic in those words. They could feel the revolutionary fervor brewing. The majority of combat troops in 1968 were either seriously injured or killed. The number of American casualties in Vietnam was not extreme, but since it was concentrated among the combat troops, it was a virtual massacre. Not to revolt amounted to suicide. They made a political decision that they didn't want to die in a war that was based on lies. This is why they had to fight back. Now, I think it's really important to stress that none of this could have happened if it hadn't been for the civil rights movement. Just like mainstream histories downplay or ignore the impact of the GI rebellion on the outcome of the war, the ones that do include it downplay or ignore the impact of the civil rights movement and the role of the black GIs and others inspired by the civil rights movement in those rebellions. As the fight for civil rights turned to black power, cities across the US exploded in cries for racial justice. And then those same protesters were sent to Vietnam. Up until World War II, mainstream Black America had been somewhat willing to participate in US wars to prove their loyalty, to demonstrate they would be willing to do whatever was asked of them if they were to be given their rights. Every time, their loyalty was rewarded with renewed barbarity. So by the time Vietnam happened, their attitude had changed somewhat. Having been on the front line of struggle for decades, they weren't convinced by the ruling class's rhetoric about defending democracy. They knew that the US was not a very democratic place. All they could see was the government's hypocrisy when it said that they would have to wait for freedom at home, but it was willing to spend millions of dollars ensuring freedom for those Vietnamese abroad. It was opinions such as these that black men went into Vietnam, and one soldier, J.J. Johnson, one of the Fort Hood Three, said this about his decision not to fight. Quote, "Civil liberties and civil rights were in the air, and I was being ordered to march in lockstep in the opposite direction." Now, Vietnam was only the second time US troops were integrated. The first time was Korea, after President Truman desegregated the armed forces after being threatened with a march on Washington by civil rights leader and trade unionist A. Philip Randolph. Obviously, racism still existed despite formal desegregation, but when the Black Congressional Caucus investigated racism in the military during Vietnam, they were still surprised to find that Black troops received a disproportionately low number of honorable discharges. They were more widely subject to pretrial confinement. They often received indifferent medical attention while in the field, and they got the most dangerous combat jobs in Vietnam if they showed any sign of militancy. Black soldiers, just like Marvin's brother Frankie, would write letters home or to the editors of Black newspapers and magazines documenting the racism they were experiencing. For example, one letter read, "You should see for yourself how the Black man is being treated over here and the way we are dying. When it comes to rank, we are left out. When it comes to special privileges, we are left out. When it comes to patrols, we are first." Another read, "The odds are against him. Sergeant Paulson handpicks men for this job. So far, it seems to me he's fingered only Negroes and Puerto Ricans. I think he's trying to tell us something." All this helps to explain some of the things I talked about earlier, including the disproportionately high number of Black soldiers killed or injured, but it also helps to explain why they were often in the vanguard of the resistance. Malcolm X was one of the earliest to speak out against the Vietnam War, initially highlighting the hypocrisy of the US government's demand of nonviolence on the Black community at home while being more than violent abroad. Martin Luther King picked up on this too in his beautiful sermon, "Why I Am Opposed to the Vietnam War," delivered 1 year before his assassination. But he also talked about the economic disparity too. There's apparently millions of dollars for war. He talked about the US spending $500,000 to kill every enemy soldier, while only spending $53 for each person classified as poor in the US. And importantly, he recognized that to speak out against the war was saying that the Vietnamese people should decide their fate for themselves, and that the best thing he could do was hold his own government to account.
My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness. For it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion, while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
This sermon is so beautiful. I'm not ashamed to tell you that if I'd been in the congregation that day and they'd asked if anyone wanted to accept Jesus Christ as their personal Lord and Savior, I might have said yes. He was so moved, so compelled to speak out against this injustice. He is so convincing of the truth of what he's saying that it's no surprise that more and more people were persuaded by his argument. Just weeks after King delivered this sermon, Muhammad Ali refused to be inducted into the draft. In a later statement, he said, quote, "No, I'm not going 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation. This is the day when such evils must come to an end. I have been warned that to take such a stand would put my prestige in jeopardy and could cause me to lose millions of dollars which should accrue to me as the champion. But I've said it once and I will say it again. The real enemy of my people is right here. I will not disgrace my religion, my people, or myself by becoming a tool to enslave those who are fighting for their own justice, freedom, and equality." The more figures from Black America spoke out against the war, the more emboldened the Black GIs became. In a survey of Black soldiers conducted for Time and the Washington Post in 1970, 64% believed that their fight was in the US, not in Vietnam, and a high percentage promised to take what they had learned in the army and channel it into organizations like the Black Panther Party. They came back radicalized by their experiences, and they knew how to use weapons, thanks to the training they got in Vietnam. Despite the extraordinary political and cultural impact that dissenting soldiers made throughout the Vietnam era, their voices have been nearly completely erased from history, replaced by a stereotypical image of loyal, patriotic soldiers antagonized and spat upon by militant anti-American, anti-war activists. This could not be further from the truth. But when your soldiers make unofficial agreements with the enemy not to shoot at each other, you have to keep that hidden. When they start openly threatening the lives of their superior officers, often following through on that threat, you have to keep that hidden. And when your soldiers are openly engaging in search and avoid missions, an open, explicitly political tactic to bring peace on the ground, you have to keep that hidden too. What replaced the truth was anecdotes about returning soldiers being called baby killers, yelled at and spat on at airports as they returned home. These stories first started appearing years after the war ended, and only after a number of films were released, either depicting scenes like this or with soldiers saying they had experienced events like this. But no evidence exists to suggest that such events actually took place. On the one hand, Congress held hearings into the GI movement and found that there was no movement, just a handful of militant extremists, nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. And on the other, a sharp divide had to be created between those who opposed the war and the soldiers who fought it, as if there was no crossover between the two groups. One of the reasons why the narrative had to be rewritten was because the soldier strategies worked. All of the different tactics employed by the GIs, search and avoid, mutiny, fragging, and so on, meant that by 1970, the number of US combat troops was down by more than 70%. By refusing to allow themselves to be cannon fodder for the ruling class, they won the war within their own army and ground troops were removed from Vietnam. They believed that the war would stop when the soldiers stopped fighting it. And so they voted on whether they should do just that. Over and over again, there were stories of units, companies, entire bases taking votes on whether they would embark on a mission or even go to Vietnam at all. Ordinary people gravitate towards the utmost democracy whenever they're given the chance, unlike our rulers who pretend we have a say, then do what they want anyway. The class relations of any army copy those of the society it serves, but in a more extreme form. Just like we're seeing with COVID, it's always acceptable for the working class to be used as live bait under capitalism, whether that's in the pursuit of profits or in the pursuit of imperialist domination. So it was always acceptable to the ruling class for the overwhelmingly Black and working class combat units to die in huge numbers. It's been said that history is written by the victors. In the case of Vietnam, it seems to have been written by the losers. The history of working class people is often distorted and forgotten, whether it's what really happened in the Russian Revolution or simply how ordinary people are always inclined towards democracy and humanity at every given opportunity. The Vietnam War formally ended with the fall of Saigon in 1975. More than 3 million Vietnamese people had been killed, and at least as many were wounded. 58,000 US soldiers died. The full history of the opposition to the Vietnam War demonstrated the immense courage of the Vietnamese people, the activists of the anti-war movement, and the soldiers on the front line could stop the seemingly undefeatable imperialist project of the US in its tracks. It's a history that deserves to be remembered, so ordinary people can gain the confidence to believe that we really do have the power to change the world. Thanks.